Senator Searley, Representative Deshaies, members of the Fish and Wildlife Committee. My name's Joel Wilkinson, and I'm the Chief Game Warden for the state of Maine. And as I was sitting here today, I recognize this is I'm entering into my fifth legislative session as the Chief Warden for the state. It's pretty interesting for me. I've been the Chief Warden since 2008, and it's been quite an experience and certainly quite an honor. I've worked for two different governors and two different commissioners. Came to work under Governor Baldacci and Commissioner Martin, and I've had the pleasure to work with Commissioner Woodcock and also the Honorable Governor LePage. So a little bit about myself, which I think is important. Everybody's telling you guys a little bit about yourselves. If you're in the activities of fish and wildlife, I feel strongly I know a little bit about it. And I've been hunting and fishing my entire life. I started fishing when my grandfather would drop me off. We had two gravel pits in Gray. I grew up in Gray. He dropped me off with literally a bamboo pole while they were crushing gravel, and I would fish when I was 7, 8, 9, 10 on Collier Brook. And that's where I really became interested in fishing, and I started hunting about age 14. I'm an avid hunter, fisherman, outdoorsman. I like to hike. I engage in all kinds of outdoor activities. So when we sit here and we talk about issues and policy is being created regarding those activities, I'm very passionate about it. I want you to know that. And I have quite a length of experience in all the fields. I started with the department in 1992 as a deputy warden. I've worked for several different law enforcement agencies, both traditional law enforcement as well as the warden service, and I've held a number of positions within the department from deputy game warden all the way up through to I was the acting commissioner for a short time under Governor LePage before Chandler was hired. They had me, and they didn't like the trial run, so they got a good guy in here. Yeah. Anyway, so. But no, so I've had a real good working knowledge of the department, the bureaus, the budget, and certainly this process, and I value it, and I respect it, and I certainly want everybody to know here, if you have any questions anytime regarding anything of the Bureau or anything within the Department, please reach out to us. Communicate with us early and often. That's generally a good thing. I like to talk about issues prior to them getting here, and that way we can all have the facts to work from, which I work in a world of facts. That's what law enforcement's based on, so certainly would appreciate that. The warden service is 137 years old this year. We started in 1880. Quite an organization, been around a long time. Very proud of that. We're structured a little different than the Bureau of Resource Management in the fact that we have five regional headquarters. We don't have as many regions. They're Gray, Sydney, Bangor, Greenville, and Ashland. That's where we have five of our regional headquarters. In each one of those headquarters, we have an office administrative assistant. That's the person, if you call one of those facilities, that answers the phones. They work for warden service. And they service the department kind of as a whole. They support resource management as well as the warden service for one department. In each one of those regional facilities is a lieutenant. They oversee three sections of wardens, which range anywhere from 5 to 8 wardens per section, and three field supervisors. So again, it's we're basically have offices from Great Ashland. We have four game ward investigators that are assigned within those regions. In addition to our field personnel, we have an aviation wing. We have four aircraft, three hangars, three pilots. We have a number of specialists. As the commissioner said, we are in charge of whitewater. The whitewater industry, not only just the licensing side and the safety side, but also the enforcement side. We have a landowner relations specialist. The commissioner spoke about that. It's a position that is very important to the Bureau. It does not have enough time to do the work they need to do, I can assure you. And you'll be hearing more about that program. We also have an outreach and education specialist. They deal primarily with working with Jim's side of the shop, and as well as Bonnie in information education and promoting safety, reaching out to youth, and is one of the coordinators of a camp that the department initiated 2 years ago called Camp North Woods. It's a camp in which, children 8 years to 12 years old, are selected to go every year. Last year we had 220, kids. 110 girls, 8 to 12, and 110 boys, and they get kind of entrenched in outdoor activities from boating to confidence walls to fishing to shooting sports to riding ATVs to anything you could think of in the outdoors. It's kind of a little bit of a taster for them. It gives them some confidence and some education. In addition to that, we have administrative support in the main office. We have two administrative support positions there that work for myself and the major. And we have a chaplain, and we also have a game warden captain. The major's here today, Chris Cloutier, and I'll have him come up and say a few words in a minute just so you guys get to know him as well. He'll be over here a little bit from time to time on bills testifying when I can't make it. Our mission is very broad. If you look at our agency in relation to other conservation law enforcement agencies across the United States, we are not solely just fish and game. We have various responsibilities. We have fish and wildlife enforcement, but we also are the, by statute, responsible for inland search and rescue. We're responsible for any one of your loved ones that gets lost in the woods or waters of the state of Maine. Or if they come up against some sort of tragedy, fatality, whether it's regarding snowmobiles, boats, ATVs, or hunting-related fatalities, that is our primary responsibility. So we're a full-service law enforcement agency that provides all aspects of that. To support that, we have a number of specialty teams. We have a dive team that specializes in underwater recovery. I did that for 7 years and ran the team for 3. Quite a bit of experience in that area. We have an evidence response team in which we're an associate membership to the Maine State Police Criminal Investigations Division. So from time to time, you may see a scene where game wardens are help processing the scene. We have a particular expertise in outdoor crime scenes because that's the environment in which we work. So we're often called to assist them on outdoor homicide scenes and things of that nature. We have a forensic mapping team, which basically reconstructs accident scenes, much like on the highway. It looks at contributing factors to the accidents and also supports any potential prosecution with the district attorney's office or the attorney general's office if, in fact, we choose to move forward. We have a canine team, which some of you may or may not be familiar with, very active canine team that's responsible for a good number of saves and recoveries every year, finding people that are lost, stranded in the woods, as well as their trained cadaver dogs to look for bodies. We have an incident management team, and that team basically manages the complex world of search and rescue, and from logistics to planning to management to everything that comes with a full-scale extended search and rescue operation, we have a team that's trained for that. Our mission is one in which we are one of only two agencies that are 24-hour, 7-days-a-week call law enforcement agency. Our officers are on call when they're on call for 24 hours. Us and the Maine Marine Patrol have that. Unlike state police, they're on a 12-hour shift. Our officers are actually on for 24 hours when they're scheduled on. As you can imagine, that's quite an impact to somebody's way of life and the predictability. So we couldn't do it with an agency our size and service the whole state if we didn't have a 24-hour call. But it's a significant one and one that I think is worthy for the committee to understand. So when you have an issue with a local warden, you're contacting them at home or whatever, they take calls 20, around the clock when they're working. We handle about 19,000 to 21,000 roughly average calls for service from the public a year. That's a lot of calls for service for 124 staff. And we average 130,000 interactions a year with the public. We, by virtue of what we do and the nature of the work we do, we probably interact with the public significantly more than any other branch of the department because we're out in the field doing the inspections and things of that nature. We also work hand-in-hand with landowners, as the commissioner pointed out, and he did a good job kind of setting the tone of that. And I just want to reinforce that everything we do, everything this committee makes decisions on would not be available if we didn't have private land and public access to that private land. So it's been a commitment of mine, and it's been an enforcement priority of mine, that the landowner is generally always right. And that's a tough thing to do at times. But we find ourselves in situations mediating issues with public access to private land a lot. And we do, we work very hard to satisfy our landowners to keep land open and not get more land posted. Mm-hmm. So when you hear us, when you hear me talk specifically about issues, I think you'll see there's a fairly consistent message there regarding landowners and the importance of that relationship with the department and all of us who enjoy what we do. Whether you bird watch, hike, pick berries, it doesn't matter. You're on somebody's land most of the time. From a search and rescue perspective, we average about 382 searches a year. The average cost of those the last 3 years is about $366,000 a year. And if you look at what we actually do for what it costs, it's a pretty good investment, and we do it fairly efficiently, which I'm very proud of. As far as our funding goes, we're funded with a mix of general fund, other special revenue, as well as federal funds. So our other special revenue funding comes from the Whitewater Rafting Fund, which comes in from head fees. People going down the river through commercial operations, the outfitters pay a head fee, and we get a portion of that, as well as Department of Conservation, and that funds one position and two part-time positions, which basically works with the industry on the licensing aspect of becoming a whitewater guide, works on any landowner relation issues. Most of the rafting that occur, road use issues occur on those private lands where the buses and people are being transported and people camp and all that comes with that. It's a significant host issue, so it comes from that. We have a dedicated account where a lot of people, when we conduct search and rescues, donate money back to the department. If we've recovered one of their loved ones or we've made a save, they want to find a way to give back and provide equipment and training potentially. So we have an account where that money can go in there. It's dedicated to that and for that purpose and is utilized. We receive 7% of the non-resident snowmobile registrations. That's essentially what we receive to do snowmobile enforcement. And that pays for capital equipment, overtime, training, things of that nature. Last year, we had low registrations, so we didn't have as much money in the account to replenish sleds and do things of that nature. But most of our operations for snowmobiling come out of that fund, so that's important to note for you. We get a portion of the lake and river protection sticker that's paid. It goes into your registration now. It used to be a separate sticker. If you're non-resident, you still have to get it. We get a component of that. And we also get money from the Support Landowners program, the program that Corporal LaFlame's running, where you can become an outdoor partner. A portion of that money goes in, and we work with landowners, and we do enforcement details. And we do cleanup days, something that's fairly new to us, and we'll speak more about that as we go on. Our federal funding, we have very limited federal funding, unlike Director Conley and Resource Management. They have a lot of federal funds that come back for wildlife and fisheries issues. We get very limited funding from the federal government. We do get a grant from the Recreational Boating Safety Grant administered through the United States Coast Guard and the Department of Homeland Security. That money is used for both enforcement on the marine side as well as the inland side. We split the money 75-25 with the Department of Marine Resources and the Marine Patrol. And it also is used for outdoor education, boating education, as well as helping Bill Swan with a portion of his licensing and registration. We received some additional funds from the Department of Homeland Security through MEMA. We're a member of the Emergency Operations Center, so if there is a statewide emergency, a state of emergency ordered in the state of Maine, we have staff at that table because of our search and rescue nexus, because of the equipment we have and the training we have to help deal with rescue situations or extracting people in flood zones, things of that nature. So that's pretty much the breakdown of our funds. About 5.3% of my budget's federal funding, 5.8% other special revenue, and the rest of the budget comes from general fund in nature. One thing I do want to add that I think is of significant importance is we've lost 15 wardens in the line of duty. Conservation law enforcement is inherently risky, not only dealing with people that may not like law enforcement or do everything they can to get away from law enforcement, but just the risks of the job. We're generally called when everybody else is at home because their loved one hasn't been home and the weather's bad, or they're overdue, or something along that nature. And diving under ice, things of that nature, flying planes in remote areas and tough conditions, those are all inherent risks to the job. So It's something I take very seriously with our training with our staff. When we hire game wardens, they go through the basic 18-week training program with state police officers, county sheriffs, and municipal officers. And then we have an additional 12-week advanced school where we teach them advanced warden skills. We're getting ready to kick off our Advanced Warden Academy the end of January. We're going to have a class of 10 new wardens, which we're very excited about. And when graduation gets here, you'll all get an invitation and would certainly love to have you come support them at their graduation and show their your support to them. So with that, that's kind of a brief overview. The commissioner wanted brevity, so hopefully I met that standard. But I'm more than willing to ask any answer any questions you have.
Any questions?
And real quickly, I'm just going to have the major come up and introduce himself real quick.
Sure. I'm kind of glad we got that blue alert passed, but
very good.
Situations like that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Colonel. Senator Seaway, Representative Duchesne, members of the Fish and Wildlife Committee. I'm Chris Cloutier. I'm the major for the Warden Service. I'll keep it quick. I'm in charge of field operations. So the various divisions within the Bureau, the Colonel mentioned, they report back to me as well as the Aviation Division. One of the things I will mention is I'm the department's Wildlife Violators Compact Administrator. So if you're convicted in Maine of a fish and wildlife violation that deserves a revocation, that name gets entered into the Wildlife Violators Compact. There are approximately 46 to 47 other states that are a member, so your ability to recreate in other states could be impacted by your conduct here in this state and vice versa. As of last week, New Jersey just came on board, which is really good. We only have one other state in the Northeast that isn't a member of the compact, and that's Massachusetts, and we're working really hard to get them on board. As well as being Maine's compact administrator, I'm actually the secretary at the national level. There's three of us, a person from Ohio and Colorado, managing the compact for the states. So that's pretty neat. I also sit on the Criminal Justice, Maine Criminal Justice Academy's Policy Review Committee as a state representative. There's seven of us on the committee. We look at and review all of the mandated policies as well as recommended policies for the academy. And with that, I'll just offer it up for any questions.
Any questions? Representative Reed.
If someone has violated this law, what are the repercussions of that?
Sure. If, let's say it's a Maine resident and they've 900 a deer and they're convicted, that carries with it a one-year mandatory revocation period. That name gets entered into the compact. If that person tries to travel to another state and hunt, and the state is a participant in the compact, they would not be able to buy a license in that state. If you're a Maine resident and you travel out of state and you were convicted of night hunting in another state, they would report back to us that the resident was summons convicted for night hunting in that state, and you would actually lose your right to hunt in-state as a resident for the compact period time frame, which might be a year, 2 years, or 3 years, depending on that state. So there's actually a data entry portal, so to speak, that we can enter names into and pull names out of. It's a pretty valuable tool, because when people lose their right to hunt here, they want to try and go to another state and hunt. And so it's a pretty big deterrent. It also helps us if we have a non-resident come to the state, they're actually caught, issued a summons, and they fail to appear in court. We can actually start the suspension period in their state. There's a process to that with letters and certified mail, so it actually helps. We actually utilized that last year in a moose case for the first time. So the person actually failed to appear on a significant moose case, and through the jumping through the hoops of the compact, we were able to get that taken care of.
Great. That's a good thing.
You don't visualize this leading to the loss of the right to own firearms?
I don't. It's not connected to that.
Okay, good.
Representative Netto?
So, my question is, I know you mentioned how many states participate.
Yes.
So, you eliminated Massachusetts because they're not participating right now. And what other states don't?
I can get back to you on that. I can picture A couple of the member states in my head, but I will get it wrong if I try, and I don't want to.
Right.
So I'll actually send you a map.
Okay. That would be wonderful. I love maps. And so my next question on that is...
try to decide where to hunt.
Yeah, when or when not to.
Right.
You don't need to worry. I'm not on your list. I can guarantee you. You're saying right now, if you get caught doing something illegal, in your instances, you said nighttime hunting?
Yes, night hunting.
Night
which
hunting.
Would be illegal.
Okay. Which that includes that headlight that you illegally have on your car to...
You could headlights on your car, a spotlight, night vision equipment,
yeah.
Anything
okay.
to this.
And so there's a 1 year that you lose your license.
Yes, a minimum 1 year. And we actually have several statutes that require a minimum revocation period. Night hunting, exceeding the bag limit on deer, exceeding the bag limit on moose, are just a couple of examples. We have several other statutes that have that.
But there's also carve-outs for these. Say you own a strawberry farm and
yes.
they are bothering you, then you actually can shoot as many deer as you want to, which is not right. But, I mean, that's, in my eyes,
so, yeah,
that's
we have,
how it is.
Yeah, there are statutes that take into account depredation or damage caused to crops and other instances where you can shoot deer at night legally. With the right permits.
Can you really shoot as many as you want to? Or is there a limit on even that?
Theoretically, it would be unlimited, but that's actually in practicality isn't how it works. So
okay.
You can shoot upwards of three to possess, and then those deer beyond the three start getting given away to the Hunters for the Hungry program and whatnot. But what we've found is usually one or two animals being taken out of the area tends to...
discourage the rest.
Yeah, for the most part.
So I'm really green, so I'm going to ask you a lot of probably stupid questions, and I can't apologize for that because I don't know. So you guys all know, but I'm not listening to you. I have them, so I have to ask these questions. And I apologize ahead of time, but I do and I don't. So thank you for your answers, but... I need to ask you while you're here, so I appreciate that a lot. You have no idea.
Not a problem. If you can't reach the Colonel, you can reach myself. Cell phone, text, you name it. You can get a hold of us, which is interesting because when I started, it was a calling card, and you had to know where every payphone in your area of responsibility was, and it could take you upwards of an hour to an hour and a half to get back to a complainant, and now with cell phones, people expect an answer within 5 minutes. So it's interesting.
Also, Representative Netto, no question's a bad question here.
Yeah.
We just like having fun, that's all. Representative Wood.
Thanks, Senator. All the game ones are able to receive texts on their phones now?
Yes.
I know because a couple years ago they weren't.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
I appreciate what you do, and thank you.
Thanks.